Hello and welcome to the CFO Playbook podcast. My name's David McClelland. I'm a journalist and broadcaster. I cover business, technology and leadership. And right here on the CFO Playbook, I get under the skin of how world-class finance leaders from across various industries execute strategy, leverage technology, lead effectively and much, much more. And in today's episode, we're talking to a CFO who made an early career move from working on fighter jets to working in finance, and who now plays a key role in helping enterprises to plan for the future.
I think there's a balance here on what you're trying to achieve in the short term. If you're looking at AI as being that panacea of, oh, I'm just going to put in this solution and all of a sudden I can take out 10% of my org, I think that's a little bit short-sighted. I think you really want this to be a longer-term vision of how can you bend the curve on how your organization scales going into the future.
A reminder that CFO Playbook is here every month with exclusive interviews and insights from world-class finance leaders. So do subscribe and do listen back to our extensive back catalog. Don't be afraid to get in touch either, as many of you do. Your suggestions really do help to shape our shows. Right, let's meet today's guest.
This episode of the CFO Playbook is brought to you by Soldo. Trusted by over 25,000 organizations across 31 countries, Soldo combines pre-programmed cards, an intuitive app, and a powerful management platform to replace manual processes with efficiency and control. To find out more or to book a demo, visit soldo.com.
Heman Kapadia, CFO at Anaplan. Thank you for joining us on the CFO Playbook.
Morning, David. Thank you for having me.
And where are you joining us from today, Heman? The fact that you're saying it's morning and it's past lunchtime here in the UK where I'm recording from, that gives me a bit of a clue that you're in a very different part of the world. Where are you joining us from and what's your week look like so far?
I am joining you from Baltimore, Maryland. I start off the week in Texas. I'll be in New York the latter part of the week and then on to Miami, where Anaplan has their corporate headquarters.
Wow. Well, thank you for joining us on the road. Good morning, Baltimore, as they say in some bit of musical theater somewhere. Let's have a chat about our plan for today. It seems very apt for us to talk about the plan, given our conversation and where you work. And we'll start talking about Anaplan and about your dual-facing role there. I want to look at the journey that's taken you there, and then I really want to explore in more detail the insights that you have from your position at Anaplan about AI, about data, and about the future of finance and where organizations, your customers, are on that journey, because it is a journey, of course, right now. Does that sound like a good plan?
Sounds great.
Excellent. Right. Let's start with Anaplan. And I think it's one of those companies that will be very known to those who know it, but maybe not to all of our listeners around the globe. So perhaps could you summarize what it is that Anaplan does, who it does it for, and then touch on what your remit there is?
So Anaplan is a scenario planning, decision-making platform that truly spans across multiple buying centers, whether it be sales, finance, supply chain, or workforce planning. And the really beautiful part of it, especially in our current environment, is it truly is AI at the core, with our linear algebra calculation engine, coupled with our newly launched applications, which are purpose-built, and really allow our customers to make decisions that they could not have imagined before. And I'm sure as we get through the discussion, we can talk about some really, really compelling use cases that our customers have been able to employ, especially in our dynamic environment today, where we've got rapid changes in the tariff environment, foreign exchange rates, supply-demand characteristics. It is the solution for the times that we live in today.
Scenario planning, and like you say, well, we'll come into some specifics there. Who typically are your customers then?
We primarily serve the enterprise scale customers. So if you think about the Fortune 50, approximately half of the Fortune 50 are our customers. If you think about NVIDIA, OpenAI, you've got Coca-Cola, AWS, we've got a
broad range of customers in technology, financial services, manufacturing. It really goes to show that the breadth of the solution, because it's applicable across multiple industries, multiple verticals. We've got over 2,600 customers as of today. We're well over $1 billion in recurring revenue. We're a Rule of 55 company for those in SaaS. You'll know what that is as a combination of your growth rate and your free cash flow margins. So we've built a really, really interesting business here over the last 3 years.
Okay. And onto your role there. I mean, nominally it's three letters, the CFO, but as we know on this show, probably more than most out there, that can cover a multitude of bases there. So how do you define what your remit at Anaplan is?
Yeah, so I think it starts with truly being a partner, not only to the CEO, but to really be a coach for the ever operating functions across the business, wherever. And so if I just think about my remit itself, certainly there's the finance aspect of it. I do own IT, procurement, and real estate, and deal desk from a pricing standpoint. So as I think about the relationship that I have across the business, it really is about ensuring that the teams are connected to not only their operational metrics, but they truly understand what the impact is to the business in not only the short term, but the longer term. And how do we make those strategic decisions between the investments we want to make today versus the investments that we're making for 12, 24, 36 months down the road?
I like that role in connecting the teams within the organization and helping them to understand what their impact is. I haven't heard a CFO on here quite describe their role in that way before. I think that's really interesting and something that we'll try to come back to later on. The other thing I want to touch on at this stage is this dual nature of your role, the fact that, yes, you have this internal role, as we've just touched on there, but then an external facing role as well, because typically there are CFOs in the enterprise organizations that you are working with. And I know that you have a line into them to help them understand what it is that you're doing, what the future could look like.
Absolutely. You know, it's really interesting when I joined Anaplan and understood what Anaplan actually serves enterprises with, it was really a product that I could relate to, because as a CFO, which CFO doesn't love to do planning and analysis? So this was almost like a perfect fit for me. And to your point, I spend a lot of time, and part of the reason why I'm on the road, as Willie Nelson likes to say, is that I'm talking to not only customers, but other partners about what Anaplan can bring to their enterprises and how they can go on a journey of financial transformation, or really is a business planning transformation that gets back to the earlier point about having that connectivity across an enterprise, to where if you can understand a change in one part of your business, how is that going to ripple through to another part of business and ultimately your financials. One thing that I like to share with some of our customers and prospective customers is my ability to have a daily close in effect. So if something happens to my pipeline or a booking that comes through, I understand how it impacts all of my cost levers through the enterprise. And ultimately, I get a daily view as to what my bookings, billings, and EBITDA and cash flow are. And that is a level of transparency that I've never had at another enterprise, and really allows me to make those decisions in the short term, because I know I have confidence in knowing what the outcome is going to be at the end of a quarter.
And the ability to have those insights on a daily basis as well, whereas previously, I don't know, monthly, quarterly, whatever it would have been, but really to shrink that time from insight to action is really, really valuable, particularly when you're talking about the kinds of organizations, the kind of enterprises that you work with, and particularly in let's say in the technology space with your technology clients, things are changing so very quickly, the ability to pivot. And you also mentioned, you know, the global context within which we're working at the moment, whether that's tariffs or other things that are happening around the world, that ability to pivot and make decisions quickly is absolutely critical. Fascinating. And given your internal and external role, I want to come back in a few moments' time to your reflections on exactly how these enterprises are finding wins at the moment. But first, though, a bit about your journey to this point, Hemant. And I think it's fair to say a number of our guests here on the CFO Playbook, they haven't come from a traditional finance background, but I can't think of any that began their career working on actual fighter jets. So how do you summarize your career? How did you go from F-35s to finance? And what were those defining moments that kind of crystallized your ambitions or directions?
Yeah, I definitely did not take the traditional path to finance. My brother did. He was an accountant that ultimately moved to finance. But as you said, yes, I did start off my career as an engineer. I worked on a lot of great projects. One of the last ones was a set of microelectronics for the F-35. So when I see it in action, there's a moment of pride. So that's fantastic. You know, I think the transition really happened when I could see myself working on some great projects, super cool projects, as the F-35 clearly was. But I really didn't see how that was going to impact GE in a material way. And obviously, GE was a huge enterprise, but I wanted to have what I was doing impact the business directly. So that led me to get my MBA, join GE's audit staff, which was a transitional accelerator program within GE. And then ultimately, I joined one of GE's manufacturing business, the appliance business, which is a low margin business. And you really had a lot of not only breadth and depth in your roles, because it was a low margin business. You had to get involved in a lot of different areas. And it was great to have that engineering background, which is grounded in math, analytics, processes. And that really maps over to finance really well, because again, you need to be analytical, your numbers need to be precise, and you need to make the right decision. So I think that was a natural, unnatural as it was, it did feel somewhat natural to me. And so with that, it's just been a constant evolution of just building another skill set on and adding another capability as I transitioned between roles across GE, and ultimately that led me to the C-suite, which, you know, I've just continued to bring a lot of those same learnings and capabilities.
So you spoke there about the overlap, you know, good sort of process thinking, systems thinking, maths, obviously, and so on, that from your engineering time have served you well in the finance space. As you made that transition and as you've reached that kind of rung on the ladder that you are right now, you stood on quite a few rungs of that ladder, I think, as you scaled various companies in your career. What stands out, looking from the vantage point that you have now, as the most important attributes for today's finance leaders?
You really have to be comfortable working outside of your comfort zone, if that makes sense. The reason for that is you could stay in a particular lane and continue to do that job for your entire career. But unless you find another lane that you can become an expert in or gain some level of proficiency, you're not going to expand your horizons very broadly, and consequently the impact you have on your business. So, you know, as I think about not only my career over the years, yes, switching from engineering to finance, yes, that is not even a different lane, that's a different highway. But
yeah,
but you know, as I talk to folks on my team, as I coach them or others across the organization, that's something that I've consistently come back to is, okay, you've done that for X number of years. How about you try something different? Build another skill set. Have your vision of where you want to be 10 years from now in mind. And what are those steps that are going to get you there? So I've looked at that as a little bit of a mantra and the framing of a conversation that I generally have with others in the organization.
Just a thought on that, though. And while in principle, that's great, practically speaking, that can be somewhat difficult. And yes, I appreciate the kind of mapping process of, you know, if you're going to switch to a different highway, then, you know, work out which junction you're going to be exiting from, which off-ramp and all of that. But practically speaking, particularly the more senior you get, to switch careers from a senior position, maybe in finance, I don't know, to a senior position, at least with a broadly comparable remuneration, that is quite difficult, because the thinking is, if you are going to make a big change, you might have to take a rung or two down the ladder, to go back to the ladder analogy, before you're able to re-achieve the position that you were in the original industry. Would you say that that's broadly right? And is that all part of being brave in making these decisions?
Yeah, I wouldn't go think of it from a remuneration standpoint, because ultimately there's something that's driving you to make that change, right? So if there's a personal learning aspiration that someone has, certainly remuneration is important. That's one of the reasons why we work. But I would say, yeah, there may be certain scenarios where you have to take a step backwards, you know, earn your stripes, and then progress forward. Now, coming into finance, someone that was, you know, 8 or 10 years into their career, I did have to take a step back and learn the basics and earn my stripes and then accelerate from there. But it's being able to leverage what you've done in the past and those learnings, those scars that you have, and bring those in and add value to a business. If you're able to add value to a business in a particular role, you'll be tapped for that next role, which is interesting, because at the appliance business, I did not have to go looking for my next job. I was basically tapped on the shoulder and said, well, why don't you go do this next? And I think that was a testament of, yes, I came in, I performed a certain role, and based on the performance there, I was asked to do the next one. And so I cycled through different opportunities on a clip of probably about a year and a half. And so that was a great way of me building additional capabilities, because I was going from, you know, product management to services to FP&A to manufacturing, and it really rounded out my skill sets. And each one of those opportunities was forming in one way or another.
So finally, on this point then, what would you say to people who, like you, perhaps didn't begin their career in finance but are now eager to pivot? What are the best things for them to know, and what are the best paths to explore? Because I guess not every organization that you worked in is going to have a finance accelerator program, for example.
Or a network of mentors or coaches that you can come back to, because you can be myopic in your perspective of, this is where I am, and ideally I'd love to do something different. Having someone's counsel, someone who's gone through a similar transition or has a broader perspective that can guide you from going from point A to point B, I think is priceless. So don't be afraid to ask other folks. Again, this is an element of being outside your comfort zone. It's being vulnerable and saying, hey, I really don't know what I can do. I have general ideas of what I'd like to do. Help me, right? So it's being a little bit uncomfortable and asking for help, for guidance. And many times, you know, even today myself, I'll take a step back and say, you know, is this something that we should embark on, right? And I'll perhaps reach out to someone I've worked with in the past and say, you know, what do you think about this? And I'll get a perspective. It'll be another data point that I could process and then ultimately come to a decision. But there is something to say about making a decision and moving on as opposed to just constantly just churning on a potential decision.
Certainly asking for help, reaching out, speaking with potential mentors. It's difficult to do, but generally speaking, when people are asked, people are very happy to help. And that's the thing that I think surprises people who do make that leap to ask for help, to ask for guidance. People are surprised when people are very happy to do that on the whole. Great advice. Thank you. Let's come back to the present day and AI data, future of finance. And of course, as you can imagine, on this show, we've spoken a lot over the last, I'm going to say, couple of years now about the potential that artificial intelligence has in various areas of organizations' finance operations. But what's your view on how organizations that you tend to work with, what's your view on how they're employing it right now, 3 years, let's say, certainly into the generative AI cycle? Where are organizations right now? And what's the gap between the hype and the reality as you see it?
Yeah, I think from an organization standpoint, especially with larger enterprises, they're just getting started, honestly. And if you think about enterprise scale solutions, apart from the LLMs that are out there, there really isn't a cohesive set of solutions that a company can put in place today. Certainly, if you look at the large software providers out there, there's some vaporware out there, and so there's a lot of hype. I think anyone that has AI in their name currently is getting a better valuation. From a revenue contribution standpoint, if you just listen to any of the earnings announcements, there's not a lot of AI revenue at these companies. So I think there's a transition that's occurring. The vaporware will eventually become something real. And ultimately, that will have an impact on businesses. There are some interesting point solutions that we are actually evaluating. If I just think about it internally, we're not only using or employing AI into our products, which we could talk about, but then also thinking about how AI is going to impact the way we operate on a daily basis. There's certainly, from an engineering perspective, there's some solutions out there that make engineers and software engineers more productive. Fantastic. And that's something that we're actively looking at. There's point solutions, again, that aren't really integrated that could help with a sales process, demo creation, et cetera. And then there's some back office point solutions that can help in finance or legal or maybe even in HR. But I think one of the challenges that how do we make this transition to AI solutions without bringing our network to its knees? And what I mean by that is you put in all of these point solutions. They're all looking to get to your email, to your Slack, to your ERP, and they're all calling for the same data. So if you have 20 solutions, all looking for the same data, you're going to bring your network to its knees. And so there's a balance here on what solutions you put in, what you want to get out, and is it going to drive the efficiencies and or visibility that you want?
I think I've mentioned it before on this show. I was in conversation with a CIO recently, and they spoke about the three P's of AI in terms of how they look at, how they think about it within their organization. So yes, productivity, process and product. Those three P's kind of encapsulate the different ways in which organizations can look, I guess, both inwardly and outwardly at AI. And interestingly, I was at a tech event in the UK this week, shout out to Birmingham Tech Week, where, and I won't name names, but the keynote sponsor was talking about how AI needs to move just beyond just the personal productivity wins in order to realize its full potential. So yes, the chat bots, the things that can help me to summarize my inbox and notate the meetings and maybe write a difficult email or presentation, there's definite value there, but there's only so much of a win that can bring kind of at a broader organizational level. So that's where, again, that sponsor was saying that organizations need to look at the bigger AI picture to maximize the potential there. Would you agree? And where are you seeing AI deliver the most value, particularly in the finance sort of functions at the moment?
Yeah, so I would completely agree there. In finance, I would say there's opportunities in accounting that if you think about it, it's the next level of automation, if you will, right? So there's been RPA that has been around for some time. I think with the advent of AI, it really takes RPA to the next level and expands the what you can do through automation. Now, from a forecasting capability, so one of the products that we have is a AI ML based forecasting and optimizer, which says, okay, well, based on my historical performance and based on certain inputs, whether it be foreign exchange or weather patterns or you name it, I could take that data in and have a prediction on what my forecast should be or for a particular metric. And then at the same time, then think about, how does that translate into the other parts of my business. From a forecast standpoint, that's one piece. The other aspect is really running multiple scenarios off of that, saying, okay, if that's my top line forecast, what does that mean for the rest of my business and P&L? So that encapsulates that portion. The other areas that we're seeing AI in tech, but that tech and accelerating the product development cycles really allows us to then bring a product to market sooner and with better quality. So that has a ripple-on effect with the finance teams as well. Having better insights into your business, driving better outcomes.
I think which leads me on to the next thing that I want to talk about, which is the foundational layer of all of this, which is the data itself. And, for more than half a century, the mantra in the IT world has been garbage in, garbage out. But I think where we are now with broader access to and adoption of AI and analytics and all the different stuff that sits on top of the data. But of course, AI is one of the channels now that we talk about. And the fact that it is so broadly accessible throughout organizations, those conversations around data cleanliness, around visibility of data and its reliability, they've taken on an elevated degree of importance. So I wonder what your counsel is internally and externally to ensure data quality and avoids, particularly with the AI stuff, less than useful outcomes. Is that a good way of calling hallucinations something other than what they are?
Using ChatGPT to, write you an email. The impact of having an error in that email or essay, not that students are using ChatGPT to write essays,
is of course not.
Is somewhat limited. But if you're trying to truly make business decisions based on an AI algorithm, LLM, or otherwise, it can be very challenging for a number of reasons. One, AI is not good at doing math large sets of data. So your point about data, having structured data and having context for data is so, so important. Because as we think about some of the solutions that we've been developing internally in each of our domains, if you will, whether it be sales, supply chain, finance, or workforce, we have analyst agents that are effectively trained on each of those domains. And so when you think about the underlying data, yes, it needs to be structured. It needs to have context to where a product on the front end of your business is a product all the way through. And so we've got some solutions. Our Anaplan Data Orchestrator allows data to actually have that same context all the way through. So when you're asking a multi-clause question across those lines of business, you can actually get an answer that you can rely on. So having an extra zero on the end of a on a forecasted, whether it be a supply chain procurement decision or a financial decision, that can be catastrophic. So it's something that we paid a lot of attention to in making sure that the responses that our AI solutions bring are actually ones that businesses can actually use to make day-to-day decisions.
Yeah, you're right. That context piece is so important. And the number of times it's been pointed out, you know, that sometimes even the most basic of maths, depending upon the model, but that's where some of the generative AI models fall down. And I guess this comes back to an underlying principle for any technology, really. It's using the right technology intervention in the right place. Waving an AI magic wand, I guess, at something and expecting good things to come out is not going to present good outcomes if that wasn't the right tool. And there are other tools that are better. There are other questions as well that I think we're all still coming to terms with. Tell me if I'm wrong here, but particularly around where humans fit into the AI automation landscape. And sometimes the humans are going to be the right tool for the job, but understanding where those humans should be in the loop, I think something we're still coming to grips with. But also the ethical points of view here as well, and from an operational risk point of view as well. How do you look at getting the right balance between the technology, the AI technology, and the human here?
It's a really interesting scenario. One that I've talked to my IT team about is, you know, if we have someone drafting an email based on AI and sending it to another person, and they have their email summarized and a response is written by AI, you basically have two AI just basically talking to each other. But then the two people, the recipient and sender, as the case may be, are missing the context of the conversation that the two chatbots basically had with each other. And so my concern with AI is that one, individuals in a business lose a pulse of what is truly going on, right? So there's places where AI can make a ton of sense in sifting through large data sets, coming back with key analytics on a particular scenario that you're looking at, or running multiple iterations on a possible outcome. That is a force multiplier for an analyst per se that's working within an organization. So the way I am framing it internally is, it's not about driving efficiency in the short term, meaning I've got 100 people, I should have 90 tomorrow. That's not the outcome I'm looking for. I'm looking for us to be able to make a decision, a better decision, faster. And if I can do that, our business is going to grow faster. Now, ultimately, if I was growing at 20% a year, maybe my headcount's growing at 10, 15% a year, because as a good CFO, I want leverage on margin. And so to that extent, maybe what AI does is it takes that hiring trajectory from 10 to 15% to maybe 5 to 6%. And so to that extent, I get incremental leverage out of business, and that's where I really see the productivity. So I think there's a balance here on what you're trying to achieve in the short term. If you're looking at AI as being that panacea of, oh, I'm just going to put in this solution and all of a sudden I can take out 10% of my org, I think that's a little bit short-sighted. I think you really want this to be a longer-term vision of how can you bend the curve on how your organization scales going into the future. Because we're at Anaplan, we're not thinking about where we are today, which is well over $1 billion. We're thinking about what does the organization look like when we're $2-3 billion.
And I think this brings us back the example that you shared there about you getting those reports on a daily basis and the fact that that those insights are allowing actions, and the speed with which those insights can be created is now vastly smaller than it once was. And it's enabling you now to do things above and beyond what you would have been able to do originally. That's great. Of course, you know, there'll be organizations that are experimenting with different types of automations, different types of value creation, like you just described there. I guess my two final questions, if I can bundle them into one here for this part of our conversation, is how do you build trust amongst the broader organization in these tools? And what kind of guardrails should you be putting in place as you are onboarding them, as you are experimenting and implementing them? And I guess this all does come back down to the trust piece, but also creating a framework within which that trust can grow in an org.
Yeah, I think trust is earned over time. So if you don't have trust within an organization, it's going to be hard to build it while you're doing a implementation of AI, because that the natural impulse is going to be, well, this is going to take my job. And so you really need to have that transparency with a business on, or with your employees prior to that. And that can come in the form of everybody understanding what the company's strategy is, what the goals are, what the financial performance has been. You know, we're not a public company, but I still give monthly updates of our financials. I'll do a recording or at our town halls, so everybody knows what the score is. And, you know, their bonuses are tied to it. So to that extent, it builds that trust that, yes, we're all in the same boat together. And then as there's going to be half the organization which is excited about AI and wants to learn, and another half which isn't. And so there's going to have to be a little bit of internal, call it, train the trainer or coaching of, hey, here's the types of things you could do. This is going to make your life easier. And I think this goes back to the earlier point of, this is not about, we're not looking at it to be a reason to do layoffs or reductions in force. This is really about driving efficiencies and better decisions. And as long as you're consistent with that, you can build on that trust you have in the organization. So I would say that's on the trust side. On guardrails, this is really about data security. The last thing you want is your data and your customers' information to all of a sudden be sucked up into an LLM. That would be a bad day. And so we've been very intentional about what solutions we bring in and allow access to various data across the enterprise. So having that governance on restricted access of various data, because, you know, there was the one story of this large media company that turned on, you know, Microsoft Copilot, and then people were, querying, what does so-and-so make? And all of a sudden it was bringing it back, because AI is like water. It just goes off and finds the answers to your questions. So I think having those guardrails, having the security the SOC compliance for every one of the solutions you bring in is supremely important. And there are some solutions where our security team has said, this is not the solution for us. So I've told my team, okay, back to square one. We're not going to compromise our data security based on, you know, the promise of some solution figuring out over time. If it's not ready now, it's not going to come into our enterprise. And I think that's, when you think about large enterprises, they're going to be a lot more careful about what they bring in. And that may be what you're seeing, a slower pace of adoption of AI solutions across larger enterprises.
The larger the organization, maybe the more conservative, little c they are about employing new technology, particularly where there's an element of risk attached to it, because there is more for them to lose potentially. The taller they are, the harder they fall and all of that. But you need to do this right because the stakes are so very high. Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Some quick fire questions towards the end of our conversation, Hemant. I want to take a moment to ask you about expenses, because the CFO Playbook is co-created in partnership with Soldo, the spend management platform that helps modern finance teams control company-wide spending with visibility, automation, and accountability. And well, they've recently published a report called Blurred Lines with some interesting findings, I think, including one which found 73% of UK employees say that they hesitate before submitting an expense claim. 70% of finance leaders, well, only 70% of finance leaders believe employees understand the expense rule. So clearly there's some hesitancy behind expenses here. What's your feeling on expense culture and building trust in company-wide financial behaviors?
It is an interesting phenomenon. It's one that I've seen over many businesses. And I think it starts with what we talked about earlier, which is transparency across a business, right? So sharing your financials, having everybody be on the same page, everybody understands the metrics and what the ultimate goal is, not only for the current year, but into the future. And the reason I go through that is if you have employees that behave like owners, right? If they have a portion of the equity or if the bonuses are tied to a particular outcome, then they're going to think about spending the company's money like they're spending their own. So it's that owner mindset that you really have to instill. And it's something that we've been working on for the last 3 years at Anaplan. And there's always someone that does something a little unique and they'll get an email from me. And the next time around, it doesn't happen. So It requires a little bit more diligence or effort from my standpoint, but I think it's part of just creating that culture of you need to have an owner mindset. And that's something that my team has adopted that mantra as well and really driven it as well.
That kind of owner stakeholder culture that you create, it can also be very empowering for the workforce as well when they do feel as though they have a real stake in there. And I'm sure that can manifest itself in a number of behaviors alongside, you know, good expenses and good financial management. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for that. Here on CFO Playbook, of course, we speak with a wealth of finance leaders from around the world across many different industries. And we hear so many unique insights, lots of nuggets of knowledge. And we thought, well, what if we had a virtual CFO Playbook into which each month we submit a new entry from our guest, a piece of advice that you wish you were given, an experience that shaped you, or just a tip to help your fellow finance professionals. So, Hemant, what would your contribution to our CFO Playbook be?
Working outside your comfort zone. That has been the one thing that I've been coached in the past and has really helped me get to where I am today. I could have stayed in engineering and I could have had a great career, but I think I would have left so much more on the table and not contributed to businesses in the way that I have. And I've been at a number of different businesses, turnarounds that led to successful exits and so forth. But it's really been not only changing industries, changing roles, types of roles, different experiences. I would really just lean back on that one. It is empowering. It is enabling, and you will just be a better person in the end for it.
And going back to the point that you made earlier on, Hemant, it's also one of the key enablers for that is building a network, reaching out to a network, asking for support for mentorship, as well as just one of those enablers, one of those steps that will help to teach you, give you confidence as well on stepping outside of your lane. Great tip. Thank you very much. And then finally, at the end of each of our conversations here on the CFO Playbook, we like to ask a parting question, and we call it our showstopper question. And we ask our guests to give us their reflections on a phrase. And this series, that phrase is progressive finance. So, Hemant, what does progressive finance mean to you?
Wow, that's a term I haven't heard before, but let me just give you my immediate reaction to it. My view on that would be, like, I would want my finance teams to not be rear view mirror oriented. So what I would want them to do is to be in the boat and not only looking at the present, but looking out into what the future of the business should be, right? And so what that means is they're in the boat rowing, as opposed to standing on the pier, you know, directing traffic. And then rowing in the same direction as everyone else, as opposed to saying after the fact, hey, you guys rowed in the wrong direction. So they should be not only rowing, but also guiding at the same time. And so I think that is a hallmark of any good finance team. They're going to be partners with each of the business units or business functions, and they should be in the boat rowing in the same direction. That should be aligned to a company's strategy.
It's a very, very powerful visual that you've created for us there. Thank you. Thank you. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Hemant, thank you so much for joining us here on the CFO Playbook.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
And before we go, big congratulations to our three winners of the Ultimate CFO Library in our recent podcast competition. Each of our winners will receive a curated collection of the very best finance and leadership books to help sharpen their strategic edge. Big thanks to everybody who entered. And, well, don't forget to join us every month here on the CFO Playbook for more chances to win, as well as more insights from finance leaders. But for now, from me, David McClelland, bye-bye.